Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou and joined in studio by our longtime host, Brian Becker. 70 years ago, more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their home in a horrific act of ethnic cleansing to make way for the creation of the new state of Israel. This event came to be known as the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. We are honored to be joined in studio by Amina El Ashkar and Kala Hamad, who are on a speaking tour of the United States to educate the public on the Nakba. Amina El Ashkar was born in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and Kala Hamad is a survivor of the Nakba who has lived in Lebanon since being forced from her home in 1948. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
So, Amina, let's start with you. Just explain for our audience, what is the Nakba?
So, as you have mentioned, Nakba is the English or the Arabic word for catastrophe, and it identifies or shows what happened or means what happened in back in 1948 for more than 750,000 Palestinians that were ethnically cleansed from their lands, houses, properties in Palestine, historic Palestine, and in what now is claimed to be the state of Israel.
The dominant narrative that came from those who founded the state of Israel was that it was a homeland for the Jewish people, that it was a land without people for a people without land, that it would be the answer to the Holocaust, the fascist Holocaust of Europe in the late 1930s and 1940s. But obviously, it wasn't a land without people. There were people, your family was there.
My grandparents, my great-grandparents have lived there as far as they can remember. That false slogan was used by the leaders of Zionism back in 1901 in order to legitimize Zionism and to legitimize what they were planning on doing, which was the creation of the State of Israel. So they started spreading that slogan that Palestine is a land without a people for a people without a land. And actually, in my presentation for the tour that we're having right now, I make sure to show people some of the photos that have been taken during the 1800s and the 1900s for Palestine, which shows Palestinians that have occupied that land or lived in that land for, you know, hundreds of years. So this is a false claim used by them.
And just before we go to Kuala, I want to ask you, the people who lived in historic Palestine were Muslim, Christians,
and Jews.
So in other words, it wasn't belonging to any particular religion.
That's true. It never belonged to any particular religion. Muslims were the majority, but it never meant that it was owned by them. It never meant like that. And actually, you can tell that by the stories that our ancestors keep on telling us, that people never differentiated between each other's religions, especially the people in the villages and stuff like that. They never actually differentiated. They never said, this is a Muslim, this is a Jew, this is a Christian. We're not going to treat them or deal with them or anything like that. So that's basically true, what you said.
Kala Hamad, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us about your story. Tell us what happened to you in the 1948 Nakba.
My name is Khawla Hamad. I came from a small village in Palestine, and it's called Kabri Village. In that village, we used to live a very peaceful and happy life with our neighbors. We were surrounded by several settlements. In those settlements, Jews used to live, local Jews. I still remember the names of these settlements, Jwella, Naharia, Masuba, and Hanuta. It was a very, very normal life with each other. We even used to sell them our dairy products, vegetables, and fruits, and they used to sell us fabrics and all sorts of things that they used to manufacture inside their settlements. And we also used to go to their settlements for medication. I still remember the names of the doctors like Natan, Maryam, and Kiwi. And the relationships stayed like that until one day we got a news that the Jews are coming to take over a land that was part of our village. The news said that they're coming to take over it. It was, and that land had over it a very ancient castle. And the Jews are coming to take that castle as well. And what actually happened that later at that day, a big troop of Jews, they came in 12 vehicles protected or under the protection of two British tanks. They came and they tried to go into our village. So there a debate started between us and them, the villagers of Kabri and them. So they wanted to take over the castle by force, but we refused that. And that's when a very big battle outbroke between us and them. So after we did not allow them to go into our village, some of them went back to Akka, the main city of Akka, and they used the British artillery to bombard our village. We waited 2 hours or 3 hours for the bombardment to stop, but it never stopped. So all the villagers in Kabri left the village and went to the fields. They wanted to just protect their children and their elderly from the bombing that was happening in the village. So we stayed, we didn't want to stay just in the wilderness, so we kept walking until we reached another village and we stayed there, but the planes came after us and they started bombing that village as well. So after they came and they bombed the village, we had to run away also along with the villagers of that town. So we walked until we reached the Lebanese border. And that's when we were trying to go into Lebanon, running away from what was happening, but the Lebanese army did not allow us to go into Lebanon. So we stayed for 7 months under the skies in the wilderness on the Palestinian territories, but by the Lebanese border.
And what was life like when you first arrived?
As I said, we stayed for 7 months in the wilderness by the Lebanese border. We had no food with us. We had no water. The kids had to go to the bushes and the trees and get whatever they find in order to eat. We also didn't have any water, but we found a small pond that the animals used to drink from. So we had to go to that pond and just get the water, boil it, and give it to the kids or whoever wants to drink. But boiling the water was not enough to actually make it healthy or drinkable water. So many people died because of that. They got contaminated. And many people also died because of starvation. So can you just imagine that people had to stay for 7 months just in the wilderness, no houses, no nothing. And that was a very big reason or major reason why many people passed away at that time.
It's just amazing how strong people must have been to be able to endure that. How did people make it through?
We had no other choice but to actually try to survive. Many people tried to go back to the to our village, but we could not make it because the soldiers had already spread throughout the whole area, and they were also backed up by the British army. So we as people had no arms, we had no weapons in order to fight them, so we had nothing but to stay there and try to survive.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, and we're also talking to Amina El-Ashkar. She was born in a refugee camp in Lebanon. Her family was originally from Palestine, and Kala Hamad is a survivor of the ethnic cleansing that was carried out by those who then created what is called today the State of Israel. Kala is talking to us about her experience, about how her village was bombed, how they fled, how they went to Lebanon, how they lived for 7 months in the wilderness, how many people died from hunger or from thirst or from contaminated water. Amina, you're not the same generation. You're young, and you have been living your whole life as many of the people who fled those villages in a refugee camp in Lebanon. Talk about what that means, what that's like. Why are the Palestinians who fled or who were forced out during the Nakba, the catastrophe, why are they still in refugee camps?
So Palestinians, what happened after 1948 was, as Khawla was saying, they had to stay for a few months on the borders until later on the United Nations came and they started assigning people to different refugee camps. And people had to live inside tents in these refugee camps for couple of years. Some of them had to live for 3 years, 4 years inside tents. And that was the very beginning of how the refugee camps were created in Lebanon, at least. And so why we're still living inside these refugee camps? Because the same way people during when they were exiled, I'm talking about Khawla's experience, the same way that she didn't have any other choice but to stay at that area, we also Palestinians inside these refugee camps have no other choice but to stay inside these refugee camps, given the conditions or the circumstances that we have to go through living under the Lebanese government's the decrees and everything that the Lebanese government issues towards the Palestinian refugees inside the refugee camps. What I mean is that the Palestinians cannot leave and live outside the camps because they're not allowed.
Yeah, let me just ask you about that. In other words, you're Palestinian. You've lived your entire life in Lebanon in a refugee camp. If you go to school and become a doctor or become a lawyer or become an engineer, are you able to work?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. So the Palestinians in Lebanon do not have the right to work in 72 professions, including all what you have mentioned. And adding to that, like I'm a translator, but I cannot work legally as a translator or have my own office because I'm Palestinian. Then the Palestinians in Lebanon cannot own any properties outside the refugee camps because they're simply Palestinians or Palestinian refugees. So they have no other choice but to live inside these refugee camps or to rent outside the camps. But it's usually too expensive for us. So
let me ask you a final question. We have 1 minute left. You're here. You're touring the United States with what you call the Nakba tour. What's your main goal and what's your main message to the people in the United States? We have about 60 seconds.
So what we try to say here or what we're trying to do here is to raise awareness of the biggest refugee crisis in our modern history. We're trying to tell people, yes, there are lots of refugees now, but us, we have a very unique situation and condition that the U.S. government can actually change somehow. So that's why we chose to speak to the American public and the Canadian public as well. And so we expect from people to educate themselves more on this issue. And we want them to, get in contact with their representatives and in order to make them ask them to bring up the refugee crisis, the Palestinian refugee crisis, more on their agendas. So at some point, people will start talking or get back to talking about us.
Walter, May is the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, the catastrophe, the ethnic cleansing of so many hundreds of thousands of Palestinian people. And as our guests are saying, still living as refugees, even though the United Nations, starting back in the 1940s, said all of the Palestinians had the right to return home. And of course, for us, for people in the United States, the Israeli government is the largest beneficiary of U.S. Foreign military aid and economic aid, about $4 or $5 billion a year. Thank you so much for joining our show.